I'm Nathan Rutherford, and welcome to Myth Madness. Last episode, I began covering the myths for the Greek hero Heracles. I covered the adventures of his father Amphitryon, the seduction of his mother Alcmene by Zeus, and the birth of Heracles and his brother Iphicles. In Heracles' early years, his exploits hint at a dangerous rage hiding below the surface, and a divine enemy in the form of Hera. Both of those came together in Heracles' tragic murder of his own family, which served as the trigger for his next adventures. To be forgiven for his crimes, Heracles received instructions from the Oracle of Delphi to go to his cousin Eurystheus in Mycenae, pledge his services, and complete a series of labors, his famous 12 labors. In this episode, I cover the first 6 of those labors, and will mostly follow the order laid out in Apollodorus' library. This is the order that most people use today. Other sources give slightly different orders, and there may not have always been 12 specific labors. Heracles goes on many different adventures, and not all of them were considered labors. The traditional number of 12 labors likely became fixed sometime in the 6th or 5th century BC. The first time they appeared represented altogether in art may have been at the Temple of Zeus at Olympia. The first time the 12 were listed in literature may have been in an epic poem all about Heracles. It was called the Heracleia, and was probably written around 650 BC. It is likely the Greeks thought Heracles took a long time to complete these labors, and didn't just complete them before a short deadline. In the sculptures at Olympia, Heracles starts as a fresh-faced youth, and is shown as a matured, more rugged man at the end. At the same time, the sculptures show a watching Athena, progressing from young maiden to a more motherly figure. The 12 labors formed the backbone of Heracles' entire heroic career. After the Oracle of Delphi instructed Heracles to serve Eurystheus, the hero set out for the Argolid region of Greece, and the city of Tiryns within it, where King Eurystheus had his royal court. We don't know Eurystheus' reaction when his younger but clearly visible, stronger relative showed up at the palace. I'll guess he wasn't thrilled, and tried to get rid of Heracles by giving him the most dangerous tasks possible. All of the sources say the first task, or the first labor, Eurystheus gave to Heracles was to slay the Nemean lion and return with its flayed skin as proof of victory. So what exactly was this monstrous lion? Hesiod's Theogony, the earliest existing source from the 7th century BC, references the lion and has a lot to say on the subject. First, the Nemean lion was really quite monstrous. In fact, it was descended from Typhon, the monster of all monsters. Back at the end of episode 22 of the pod, I talked about how even though Typhon was eventually defeated by Zeus, his children survived, and how in the Age of Heroes, the focus of this season of the podcast, it would be the job of some of those heroes to finish what Zeus started. Bellerophon, when he killed the Chimera, was the first hero to do this, and made the world just a little bit safer for humans. Heracles is going to be another. Hesiod has the Nemean lion be a grandchild of Typhon, saying it was the offspring of the monstrous Chimera and the dog Orthus. Apollodorus skips this generation, and just says the lion was an offspring of Typhon. Either way, though, it was descended from our monster of all monsters, but the goddess Hera had actually raised and trained the beast. The Nemean lion lived in, you guessed it, Nemea. This was a place located very close to Eurystheus's kingdom, and it terrorized the tribes of people living near its home and ate all of their sheep. Heracles went to Nemea and found the lion at the base of a mountain, near where it made its home in a crevice in the rock. First, the hero tried to shoot it with arrows, but the Nemean lion's flesh was hardy and invulnerable to iron, bronze, or stone. The arrows just fell off its hide. This is a very common point most of the sources have. Pindar and Bacchylides in the 5th century BC, Diodorus in the 1st, and Apollodorus in the 2nd century AD all clearly point this out. Bacchylides even goes one step further, saying that even when Heracles moved in close to the lion and tried to kill it with a quick sword thrust, his sword was bent back when it came in contact with the lion's body. The Nemean lion eventually returned to its crevice home, and Heracles followed it inside after closing up the other end with debris. Heracles closed in and wound his arms around the lion's neck, trying to avoid its sharp claws and teeth. He squeezed and squeezed, choking it to death, a point all of the story's sources agree on. In the previous episode, I told how a young Heracles, when he still went by the name Alcaeus, killed the Catharian lion, and how afterwards he wore its skin over his whole body. Several other sources, such as Diodorus and Ovid, but also some others, say it was in fact the Nemean lion Heracles wore the skin of, and according to one source, he used the lion's own claws to skin the corpse. In fact, what we probably have here with these two stories is a duplication of the same story. One lion hunt taking place in Nemea, and another taking place in Thebes. Each was probably placed in those locations and celebrated by the people living in them. There is also one version that points out Heracles did not leave his fight with the Nemean lion unhurt. Ptolemy Hephaestion, writing in the 1st century AD, tells us that the Nemean lion actually bit off one of Heracles' fingers, and a temple was erected to house the remains of the severed finger. After a victorious Heracles returned to Tiryns, Eurytheus promptly sent him out again for his next trial. Heracles' second labor was to kill the Hydra. So what exactly was the Hydra? Well, like the Nemean lion, the Hydra was descended from Typhon and Echidna, so once again Heracles is helping to rid the world of some very threatening monsters. And, once again, as Hesiod explains, this monster was nourished when it was young by the goddess Hera. When I talked about Typhon and Echidna in the past, I pointed out their snake-like attributes. In this way, the Hydra took after its parents. It is essentially a giant water snake, but with multiple heads. The exact number is not consistent. The archaic period sources say 9, 50, and 100 heads. Centuries later, Diodorus agrees with the 100, but Apollodorus goes with 9, and says one of them was immortal. Another poet also says that there were multiple heads, but that one of them was made of gold. Towards the end of Greek history, the Greek travel writer Pausanias tried to rationalize all of this. He thought the Hydra only had one head, but that earlier poets wanted to improve their poetry by making the monster more scary, so they gave the Hydra many heads. To find the Hydra, Heracles needed to head to Lerna, which lies fairly close to Mycenae and Tiryns. Lerna was a marshy area with a large deep lake and a spring that was created by Poseidon. The lake contained a sunken entrance to the underworld, and somewhere in its cloudy depths was also the home of the Hydra. In this task, Heracles was not alone. His nephew, Iolaus, accompanied him to Lerna, and this is a very consistent feature of this story. Archaic period Hesiod mentions Iolaus, as does Plato in the classical period, and numerous sources that came later. Iolaus was the son of Heracles' twin brother Iphicles. In the previous episode, when I was talking about how Heracles killed his family in an insane rage, he also killed his brother's children. But Iolaus was not one of those children. Iolaus was the son of Iphicles' first wife, a woman named Automedusa. Iphicles had another wife too, a woman named Pyrrha, who was a daughter of Creon and the sister of Heracles' wife. With the second wife, Iphicles had two more sons, and these were the ones Heracles killed. In some versions of the story, Heracles killed Iphicles' sons, his own sons, and his own wife, Megara. But in others, Megara's fate is stranger. She survived, and then Heracles, after completely decimating their family, gave Megara to his nephew Iolaus to marry. In bringing this up, my point is this. Heracles and his nephew Iolaus had a very interesting relationship, certainly different to how we might imagine an uncle-nephew relationship today. Anyway, back to the Hydra. Heracles and Iolaus found their way to Lerna and reached the banks of the marshy lake there. The way Heracles and Iolaus were imagined to have killed the Hydra changed over time. In the earliest surviving source, Hesiod's Theogony, there's little detail, but Heracles killed the monster with his bronze sword. You can compare that with the Roman poet Virgil, writing several hundred years later, who claimed Heracles' weapon was his bow and arrows. But neither of those is the dominant tradition. That one is first mentioned by Euripides and the philosopher Plato, putting it squarely in the classical period, but it is also found in Apollodorus and Diodorus too. The tradition could, of course, be older. It goes like this. The problem with the Hydra, the attribute which made it particularly lethal, was that if one head was cut off, more would grow back, specifically two for every one lost. Heracles decapitated the Hydra again and again, and he soon found himself up against a snarling mass of serpent heads, and according to a few versions, a monstrous crab as well, which was supposedly sent by the goddess Hera to make the fight difficult for him. Heracles killed the crab, but to deal with the Hydra's massing heads, he had Iolaus step in. Iolaus made some torches by setting fire to a portion of the adjoining woods, and by using these to burn the buddings of the heads after Heracles decapitated them, he kept each one from growing back. This became a very popular way to describe the fight. Almost all the poets of the Roman period refer to this use of fire to kill the Hydra. Another dangerous thing about the Hydra was that it was very poisonous. After it was killed, Heracles dipped his arrows in a puddle of the monster's venom. In the future, any wounds caused by Heracles' arrows, even just the tiniest scratch, would be incurable. So, the Hydra was killed, and Heracles completed his second labor. The hero and his nephew made quite the team. Surely the two of them could make quick work of the rest of the labors. Unfortunately, when Heracles returned to Tiryns, Eurystheus was not pleased. He declared that Heracles had cheated, and that he would not accept the killing of the Hydra as a completed labor, since Heracles was helped by someone else. Going forward, Iolaus was unable to join Heracles on his quests. The next labor was a little different. Instead of killing a monster, Heracles was tasked with capturing an animal and returning with it alive. There are actually a couple labors like this, but the animal that was the focus of this one was the Carinthian hind. Hind is another word for deer. This deer didn't breathe fire or eat people or anything, but the task was still a dangerous one. The reason being, the deer was sacred to the goddess Artemis, and all of the gods do not take it well when insulted by mortals. The hind itself has a history with Artemis. In days long past, when Artemis was young and had not yet arrived on Mount Olympus to take her place as one of the 12 Olympians, she was where she often was, hunting in the dark forests of Arcadia. She found a herd of 5 deer, but these weren't any old deer. They were larger than bulls, and their horns were gold. Artemis ran 4 of the deer down on foot and captured them, intending to use them to pull her chariot. But the 5th deer got away. Hera intervened, maybe by causing Artemis to trip or twist an ankle. However it was, though, the deer escaped over a river and hid in Carinaea. Many years later, it was the same deer, the same hind, that Heracles came to find. Heracles spent a whole year pursuing the deer. Diodorus points out that Heracles couldn't subdue the giant deer like some of the other creatures he had faced. Instead of relying on his sword and strength, he had to rely on his wits to catch it. He finally captured the Carinthian hind by using nets, or tracking it down and tying it up when it was asleep, or by simply running after it until it got tired. Apollodorus seems to go with that third option, saying the hind finally tired of the chase and attempted to cross a river, probably intending to escape, just as it had with Artemis so many years before. But as it was crossing, Heracles finally hit it with an arrow, something in the other versions he wasn't supposed to do. When the hind became exhausted, he hoisted the wounded animal on his shoulders and walked off through Arcadia. While he was making his way through the forests, Artemis and Apollo appeared, attempted to grab the hind away from him, and angrily told Heracles off for hurting an animal sacred to Artemis. You might expect that Heracles grew angry with the goddess, and maybe tried to fight her for it, It certainly wouldn't be out of character for him so far. But instead, surprisingly, Heracles got down on his hands and knees and begged. He told her he would never have tried to capture the hind, if Eurystheus hadn't already ordered him to first. Artemis was soothed by his words, and allowed Heracles to take the still-living wild stag with golden horns to show Eurystheus. Presumably, after that was complete, the Carinidian hind was released to go back to its home in the wild places of southern Greece. Unlike most of the other animals featured in these labors, the hind was not monstrous or dangerous, so there was really no need for it to be killed. And since it was sacred to Artemis, and Artemis did not seek revenge on Eurystheus afterwards, I don't think he had it stuffed and mounted over his palace fireplace. The next creature Heracles was sent to face, though, was not as peaceful. It was a large, dangerous boar. It foamed at the mouth and terrorized the foothills of a mountain called Eurymanthus, and the inhabitants of a city called Zophis that was located nearby. Nevertheless, Eurystheus told Heracles to bring back the Eurymanthian boar alive. He probably thought killing the thing would be easier, and so wanted to make Heracles' labor just a little more difficult. As Diodorus points out, capturing the boar was more dangerous, since it meant whoever fought the beast would have to do it at exactly the right moment in the very heat of the encounter. If the hunter failed to grab it while it was still strong, he would be in danger of its tusks. But if he tried to overpower the boar and was too violent, he might kill the animal and leave the labor unfulfilled. But before taking on the boar, Heracles made a side trip. On his way, he stopped by the home, a cave, of a centaur named Phallus. In Greek myth, the centaurs are a notoriously rowdy group. They are wild, fickle, and dangerous. But there are two centaurs that are not like this. And they are Phallus, the centaur Heracles is visiting, and Chiron, another one. Both were considered to be very wise and honorable. They are essentially centaur sages. Phallus entertained Heracles in his cave and roasted meat for the hero, while he himself ate it raw. Eventually, Heracles called for wine and opened up a large sealed jar to drink. But once the jar was opened, the wine's sweet smell wafted out and caught in the breeze. It attracted the attention of the other centaurs living nearby, and they soon arrived at the mouth of Phallus' cave. These centaurs were boisterous, loud, and quickly grew violent. They could have been drunk or driven mad by the smell, too. Either way, Heracles began to struggle with them. As Diodorus explains, the centaurs advanced upon him, some with pine trees that they used as weapons, others with great rocks, some with burning firebrands, and still others with axes, but he withstood them, without sign of fear, and fought against them. Apollodorus says Heracles fired arrows at them, and the centaurs were repelled, either killed or retreating all the way to the cave of the other centaur sage, Chiron. But for Heracles, the bloodlust of battle had already set in. He followed the retreating centaurs, shooting more arrows after them. When the centaurs finally reached Chiron, Heracles was still shooting arrows at them, and one arrow passed through the arm of a centaur and hit Chiron in the knee. It wasn't a terrible wound, but remember, Heracles' arrows dripped with the Hydra's poison, and because of that, the centaur sage Chiron soon dropped dead anyway. Meanwhile, back at Phallus' cave, Phallus was sadly burying the dead centaurs. While he did so, he pulled one of Heracles' arrows from one of the corpses and wondered how something so small could kill something as big as a centaur. In the process, he accidentally cut himself with it, and just like with Chiron, the Hydra's poison went to work, and soon Phallus, the only other centaur sage, was dead too. When Heracles returned to the cave, he found his host lying dead. Before continuing on his way, he held a funeral for his friend and buried him at the foot of the nearby mountain. Originally, Heracles went to Phallus to ask for advice from the wise centaur on how he could capture the Erymanthian boar. I don't know if he got any helpful advice, but after returning to his quest, Heracles found the boar in a dense thicket of trees in the mountains. By shouting, he flushed it out of hiding, and then drove it charging into an area of deep snow, where it quickly got stuck in the drifts and grew weak. Heracles snared it with a noose, lifted it still breathing on his left shoulder, and began his long walk back to Mycenae. Back at the court of Eurytheus, the king was so terrified by the boar, he hid inside a large bronze vase, half buried in the ground. Apollodorus actually places this funny event right after Heracles killed the Nemean lion, but Diodorus puts it here. I have chosen to also put it here, because there is a lot of Greek vase art from the 500s BC that shows Eurytheus hiding in a jar, with Heracles dangling the boar right above him. For his next labor, Heracles was ordered to drive out the Stymphalian birds roosting around Lake Stymphalos in the Arcadia region of Greece. The densely packed trees surrounding this lake were filled with the birds, which gathered in the high branches to avoid being hunted by wolves. The birds were originally raised by the god Ares before flying to Arcadia. The 2nd century AD Greek travel writer Pausanias gives the most detailed description of the Stymphalian birds. He says they feast on human flesh, and they fly in a vast swarm against any who try and hunt them, wounding and killing people with their sharp beaks. Even bronze or iron armor wouldn't stop them. The Stymphalian birds were going to be very troublesome for Heracles. They were hidden high up in the trees, and the ground around the lake was marshy and made it difficult to walk. Heracles wouldn't be able to get close to scare them out into the open air, and then, once they were in the air, he could easily be swarmed to death. Apollodorus has Heracles stumped by the problem, unsure what to do. Fortunately for him, in this version, the goddess Athena, who looks after Heracles on more than one occasion, goes to Hephaestus and persuades him to build special bronze noisemakers for Heracles. However, Diodorus, writing a couple hundred years before Apollodorus, emphasizes Heracles' craftiness in building the bronze rattles himself. Either way, though, in both versions, and also by an earlier Hellenistic poet, Apollonius of Rhodes, writing in the 3rd century BC, Heracles uses the rattle to solve his problem. Standing on the neighboring mountainside, Heracles shook the rattle, creating a terrible noise. Scared by it, the birds took to the air, flying around in a big, confused mess. With the birds not realizing what was going on, and now vulnerable in the open sky, Heracles shot them down with his poisoned arrows, cleansing the lake area. Strangely, there is one ancient source, named Menasius, a Greek historian from the 3rd century BC, who provides an alternate take. He says the Stymphalian birds were not actually birds at all, but women. Two women, to be exact, who were the daughters of an Arcadian warlord. Menasius claims Heracles killed them after they proved poor hosts. It's a very strange shift in the story, and I expect as a Hellenistic historian, Menasius was probably trying to rationalize the ancient myths in a more realistic way. He is the only person who refers to the Stymphalian birds in this way. Pausanias does provide one detail, that at Lake Stymphalos there was a temple to Artemis, and outside the back of this temple, there were marble statues of women with the legs of birds. So maybe Menasius was basing his idea off something, at least. But Pausanias says the temple also had carvings of the Stymphalian birds on it, and in his story, the beasts he has Heracles fight are very much birds. Like a lot of the other labors, the Greeks liked showing this adventure in art. A 6th century BC Athenian vase shows them clearly as birds, with long necks like swans or geese. The next labor is listed by Apollodorus as coming before the Stymphalian birds, but I thought I'd end this episode with this one, as it's one of my favorites. It's just a really weird quest. It's very different from the labors that came before, and for what it's worth, it is listed in this order by good old Diodorus. Before we get to the labor and Heracles' work to complete it, this one requires a little bit of backstory. I already talked about last episode how Heracles and Eurytheus were related, and how they were both descended from the intermarried sons of Perseus and the daughters of Pelops. Heracles, Eurytheus, and many other distant cousins all lived in the Argolid, in Mycenae, Tiryns, Trozen, and Argos, as these were the kingdoms their forefathers inherited from Perseus and Pelops. But Pelops's kingdom also extended westward, into Elis and Greek Pisa. So what was going on there? Who were the kings of the Greek city-states in that region after Pelops? Well, it's a bit more confused. There's a guy who became a lover of the moon goddess Selene, There's sons of Zeus and sons of Poseidon. There's people with very similar names. There's a king who made his three sons have a foot race to see who would inherit the throne, because of course the fastest person always makes the best king. I don't really want to get bogged down here in the legendary kings of Elis. But know this, by the time of Heracles' labors, the king of Elis was a man named Augeas. His name means bright. That could provide a hint at who his parents are, which the sources do not agree on at all. In several places, his father is Helios, the sun god. Maybe his name comes from that. But he's also referred to as a son of Poseidon. And then in other places, two different mortals are named as his father, one being one of the previous kings of Elis, and the other being the son of one. It should be noted that like a lot of Greek heroes, Augeas could have both a mortal and an immortal parent. But for him, the two fathers thing is never clearly stated. I think in real life, there's reason to believe that Augeas was actually a fairly celebrated hero among the ancient Greeks. We don't have a whole lot of myths about him today, but there's hints that there were probably other stories about him that are lost to time. He's named as one of the Argonauts, a group of sailor heroes, and there's various stories of him being involved in a war, which I'll come back to later. Augeas is most famous, though, for his stables, where the king kept his herds of cattle, and he had a lot of them, numbering in the thousands. They were possibly a gift from the gods as well. As you can imagine, all these big, strong cows, they make a lot of poop. Augeas, for whatever reason, maybe he was lazy, maybe his kingdom was suffering from a labor shortage, maybe he just couldn't keep up with it. Over the years, though, the piles of cow dung accumulated, and there was no normal way of getting rid of it. It is from this situation that we get Heracles' next labor. Previously, Eurytheus gave Heracles labors where he had to catch or kill some large or monstrous creature. Heracles completed all of them, and the nature of the tasks, the danger, and the heroics brought a lot of glory to Heracles, and in some cases, a lot of ridicule to Eurytheus, like the incident with him hiding in a jar. To change this, Eurytheus wanted to give Heracles a labor that was so insulting, so disgusting, he couldn't possibly get any glory from it. And at the same time, if it was an impossible task, all the better. To accomplish all that, Eurytheus charged Heracles with going to King Augeas and cleaning out his stables. Diodorus adds that he wasn't to accept any assistance, and Apollodorus says Heracles had to complete the cleaning in a single day. That's quite the deadline. For some of Heracles' other tasks, it took him years to complete them. Apollodorus records that Heracles went to Elis to see Augeas, but that he did not say he was sent by Eurytheus. Instead, Heracles offered to clean the stables in one day if Augeas would reward him with a selection of the cattle. Augeas couldn't believe he could do it, but agreed anyway, sending his son Phyleus to watch. When they arrived at the stables, Heracles made a breach in the foundations, basically a large trench, and then with a bit of elbow grease and the trench to lead the way, he diverted the course of a nearby river to pass water through the stables. The rushing water quickly cleaned away all the cattle poo. Diodorus chalked this all up to the ingenuity of Heracles, and his need to complete the task without being covered in filth, as Diodorus says this would lead to his disgrace. Returning to the Apollodorus version, after Heracles completed the task, Augeas learned Eurytheus ordered him to do it. Augeas declared he would not pay the reward of cattle. In fact, he even denied he ever offered to pay it. Eventually, Phyleus was called in, and he told the assembled nobles that his father had promised to give Heracles a reward. Angered at being denounced, Augeas ordered both his son Phyleus and Heracles out of Elis, and to never return. Unfortunately for Heracles, when he did finally return to Tiryns, Eurytheus told him he would not accept the completion of the labor. He found out about Heracles' arrangement with Augeas. He alleged that Heracles performed it for hire, and not as part of his sacred duty. At the beginning of the episode, I mentioned how the classic 12 labors probably solidified over time, and how Heracles did other deeds beyond the 12. The first time art shows them all together is in the wall reliefs at Olympia. Funny enough, one of these wall reliefs is central and bigger than the others, and that's the one that shows Heracles cleaning Augeas' stables. Why such an emphasis on that one? It's likely a simple answer. That was the one that was supposed to have taken place nearby. The artists at Olympia wanted to celebrate their local labor. And this may in fact be the first time the stable exploit was even considered one of the labors, and not one of Heracles' many side quests. The earliest literary reference to Augeas' stables is by Pindar in 476 BC, and he doesn't even mention it was a task given by Eurytheus. It's not mentioned in earlier sources at all. Scholars are of the opinion that it was originally a side quest and then was promoted to being a full-fledged labor because it was depicted at the large temple at Olympia. The individual Heracles most likely developed as a Peloponnesian hero, and more stories were added over time, starting with local sources and then from people further away as the Heracles stories grew in popularity. So, those are the first six Heraclean labors. Next episode, we'll continue with Heracles' quests, so stay tuned for that. If you're enjoying this podcast, please provide a 5-star review on your podcast streamer of choice. As always, thank you for listening.